you take the time to come in.
The more meetings that you have closer to home.
Speaking to the commission, we are in this room until 9 o'clock per our agenda, and so we're going to stay in here. We're going to start our meeting now, but we're going to stay in here in case there's more people show up on the for public comment. So I'm going to ask, I had some opening comments, but I'll maybe do them in the other room. Probably be more appropriate. I'm going to ask Mr. Freymeyer to come up and do his legal wizardry and tell us what he knows and what we should and shouldn't do.
Good morning. Is this good? Can you hear well enough? So the chair asked me to provide some half an hour's worth of legal context for the commission. And so I was going to cover sort of some general ideas to begin with and then talk about three sets of laws that apply to you. So general comments are the... let me get my glass of water. So, you're a state agency. State agencies are created by the legislature or through voter initiative, but you're creatures of state government. So you're limited to the laws that the legislature passes. You don't have sort of independent authority to do what you want. No state agency does. That's a little bit different than cities and counties. They have police power, public safety power, and so they can do what they need to effectuate public safety police issues. So limited authority for you. We look to the legislature or voter initiatives to give you authorities, and then you implement them. Those are laws. You have the authority to color in those laws and effectuate them by adopting rules. And we'll talk about the rule adoption process in a minute. But you have a set of rules that you've adopted that provide guidance to the agency and to the public about how your laws get implemented. So laws and then rules. You adopt rules. You have... So looking at the commission as a body, the nine of you work together as a body. You're not nine different independent directors. The commission makes decisions as a group, and you can delegate decisions to either the director. You have authority to delegate any of your authorities to the director, and you've done some of that. You can also delegate your authority to committees you create. And then they can take action for you, and we'll talk about sort of how you do that and how that needs to be complied with. But you can delegate that authority, but even then, that entity that, let's say the Wildlife Committee, let's say you delegated to the Wildlife Committee to do something, pass a rule, take some action, they would act as a body, not nine or not five, four, three individual members going off in different directions. So the commission acts as a body. out in the world, you can make, you know, sometimes you're in a situation where you're at a meeting of a sports club or something else, and people ask you, you know, on a question the commission hasn't decided, sort of what's the position of the commission. If the commission hasn't sort of acted on something, you can state your view, you can state your desire, you know, your individual viewpoint. But it would probably be improper to say to take a step of deciding as an individual the position of the commission that hadn't been decided yet. So if you make comments, you can make them in your own regard. You can make them as a Fish and Wildlife Commissioner, but as an individual Fish and Wildlife Commissioner. So enough said. We'll talk a little bit about executive sessions in the Open Public Meetings Act in just a minute, but there is confidentiality of the information that is shared by your attorneys with the commission. That's called the attorney-client privilege, and that privilege is held by the body. And so an individual commissioner can't waive the attorney-client privilege. It would have to be a group decision. So when you learn information that's confidential, I don't think it's ever come up that you've wanted to disclose confidential information, but you would have to discuss it among yourselves and decide whether you want to do that or not. It doesn't come up very much, but we just do like to remind you of that confidential nature of certain information and that it's held by the body. Okay, three laws: Open Public Meetings Act, the Administrative Procedures Act, and a little bit of public records. Let's talk about Open Public Meetings Act first. The Open Public Meetings Act is one of our open government sunshine laws. It's very powerful in the state of Washington, and it says that when multi-member bodies, government bodies, meet to do the business of the agency, they generally have to meet in public. And what that means is there has to be prior notice of the meeting, and then the public has to have the opportunity to see you act. It doesn't say that the public has to have an opportunity to speak. They just have to be able to watch you in action. So notice ahead of time, which you have your executive assistant. We work to get notices out in the proper way, and then open doors so people can come in and see you act. There are some exceptions. Let's stay with open meetings. Like I said before, the commission can create committees, and the committees don't necessarily have to comply with the open meeting requirements. If the commission were to delegate authority to take action, or the committee was going to take public testimony or sort of hold a formal hearing, those three different things would trigger the need to comply with the Open Public Meetings Act. If a committee less than a quorum met together and didn't have delegated authority, like your old committees used to do, it wasn't going to take testimony, all that, it doesn't necessarily need to meet the Open Public Meeting Act requirements. And for years, you had committees that just met quietly. That's okay. You have recently decided, or a while ago, decided to have most of your committee meetings or all of your committee meetings in public. We announce them through the regular process, and that's fine too. No problem. So anytime that a quorum of you meet, so you got nine, so five of you meet together, because that's a quorum, that would trigger the Open Public Meetings Act requirement. So we're pretty careful. You guys do the same things over and over, and we have pretty good patterns. But if something new comes up and you have a question, check with Nikki or check with me, and we can go from there. The Open Public Meetings Act, one of these sunshine laws, is liberally construed. So if there was ever to be a challenge or litigation about it, the court would apply the openness thing strongly and the narrowly construe exceptions. So that's just something to remember, that a court wouldn't look at this as just neutral. It would put its finger on the openness side, and you better have a really good explanation for an executive session. For violations of the Open Public Meetings Act, attorney's fees can be, there's no limit on attorney's fees. That, because we have a lot of litigation going now, attorney's fees have been a bigger and bigger thing for us. There are personal penalties for knowing violations of the act to the commissioner. So if a commissioner knowingly violated the act, there's a personal penalty potentially to you. The first time it's $500. After that, it's $1,000. That would be personal to you, not state money. I don't think there's been any litigation on penalties, but there have been some cases that are coming. There was one out of Seattle that got settled. But there is a lot of business in suing on open government stuff, public records and Open Public Meetings Act things. So General...
Eddie, Commissioner Thorburn.
Thank you. Is personal liability an issue in the Twin Harbors lawsuit? Personal liability in the Twin Harbors for each commissioner?
I think potentially. There has been very little litigation on it, and so there isn't a lot of case law we can look at to see sort of how it works and what the rules are. But I think that's an allegation. Yeah.
Real quick, Bill, a question I have. I question whether we should talk about any specific lawsuit.
Right. I think we should do that in October.
Okay. Mr. Baker.
In a prior life, we had a presumption that if we had checked with our counsel, the AG, and the AG had given us advice and we acted on that advice, then that would mitigate personal responsibility. Is that the case with this agency as well?
I think it's something that would certainly be raised. There isn't any case law explaining how this gets interpreted. So there isn't an exact answer, yes or no. But it would certainly be a factor, I think.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Yes, thank you. And if you're going to get to this later in your presentation, just say so. But you talked about delegation to a committee, delegating action authority to a committee that kind of perked up my ears, because I had been under the impression that only the full commission could take formal action. I know we delegate to the director for final action. So has that ever happened, and do you mean delegating final decision authority to a committee?
I believe so. The final decision authority, and you guys, some of you can probably help remind me of this, but in a prior director search, there was one of the systems the commission used was they delegated authority to a group of commissioners to do a look at the larger group of applications and propose a smaller set. And I believe that there was delegated authority for them, because I believe they met in open public meetings, to act, let's say it was 100 paper files, and they were to try to pick the best 10 to move forward, something like that. And the commission formally delegated the committee the authority to make that action. So they didn't come back with a recommendation. They came back with the 10 files. But they did meet in, they did do that, some of that, in open public meeting. Now, personal evaluations get a mix of executive session, but when they, in a personnel hiring situation, there is some review that can be done in executive session, but when the entity is going to make a decision to sort or to winnow, to pick from 100 to get to 10, that has to be done in an open setting.
Fish and Wildlife, final action, has there ever been delegated authority to a committee on that?
I don't recall that there has. I can't think of one.
I don't recall.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Are you done, Don? Okay, Commissioner Thorburn?
Well, Bill kind of got to it, but the vetting of the applications can be done in executive session, the decision about what's coming out has to be done in an open meeting, but we were able to provide some protection because it was ABCD. We didn't have to use the name, so. What the process was in that situation. So, and also it kind of explains what can be executive and what has to be done in open.
Yeah,
those kinds of things.
20 minutes. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead, Bill.
So, liberal construction on the act. If it goes to court, executive session exemptions. Where you're not meeting in public, where the body as a whole or the delegated group is not meeting in public, narrowly construed. But there are statutory reasons you can meet outside of the public view. Two of them that you use, pretty much the only two you've used, are you can meet with your attorneys, our group from the Attorney General's office, not an inside lawyer for you, but you can meet with us in executive session to talk about litigation, matters of legal risk, it is limited to the discussion with your lawyers in general. I mean, there may need to be staff to help sort of color the discussion, but it is not not a place where we're just there and that you can do whatever you want. It's a discussion with your lawyers. There are personnel evaluations that you can do of your employees. You can't take final action. So if you were to raise or reduce a salary, you could talk about that in executive session. But when you take the action, you have to come out and do it in public. So those are the two that you often or that you use. There is one about real estate. It is really narrow. The way this agency proposes and you consider real estate transactions, it has only rarely come up. And it's difficult to use. Those we try to do, we are careful about making sure you remember sort of what the bounds of those things are, because it's painful to, have discussions about whether there's compliance or not. So,
Mr. Thorburn.
So I think you're moving off Open Public Meetings Act.
One more little bit.
Oh, okay.
Just to add color.
So
not only do you get my view of these things and our division's view, for the last number of years, but particularly this attorney general, has had made a bigger deal of open government at his highest levels. And the attorney general, Bob Ferguson, now has an assistant attorney general who is the open government ombudsperson. And her job is to advise agencies, and particularly because the attorney general knows we advise you, she spends a lot of time training local governments, cities, counties, fire districts, all the ones that also need to comply with these open government laws. She provides a lot of training. She does answer. She is sort of a forum for newspapers, for citizens to contact. And so she gets asked a lot of questions by newspapers who then write her answer. You know, Nancy said this, you know, and she's very careful. She talks with a lot of us, but she takes, you know, her view, and I think counsels with the attorney general on hot topics, but there sometimes is a different view that comes out in the newspaper, and so we are very cognizant of needing to check in with her about what she would say on a controversial issue so that you can know how it may get portrayed in the paper by the Office of the Attorney General. So
if I could just...
Mr. Thorburn.
One addition that I didn't hear you say. It's we as the decision-making body that has to operate under the Open Public Meetings Act. Staff meetings are not under that act. I just wanted to make that separation. But I think the ethic of our department is to be very sunshine. When we have advisory meetings and that sort of thing, we do a lot of public outreach and that sort of thing. But we're not obligated to do that. It's the commission that's obligated under the Open Public Meetings Act. Isn't that correct?
That's my belief. That issue is out there, but that's my belief that the commission entities the commission creates, you know, may be subject to the act, but entities the director creates, we don't believe are. Now, I agree that the department does an extraordinary job of outreach and advisory committees and investment of the public.
If I may, Bill, we've got 15 minutes left on this piece.
Okay.
So I would suggest we give you 10 minutes straight up without interruptions if possible, and then we got 5 minutes for the commission to ask questions.
Okay. I'm good on, yeah. The one issue that the commission, we have not found a good way to work through is when the commission wants to meet with tribal governments or tribal governments want to meet with the commission, and it is a difficult thing to work through. So for the most part, we've sort of avoided it recently. But it is something that, you know, it's a longstanding sort of issue. Okay, so that was Open Public Meetings Act. Another important procedural law is the Administrative Procedures Act. And it's called, we call it the APA, and it has two big sides of it. Half of it is about rulemaking, and that is extremely important to the commission. The commission adopts a lot of rules on behalf of the department. The other half is what's called the adjudicative hearing process. And the commission doesn't hold hearings. It doesn't make individual licensing decisions or license suspensions or things like that. It just has never done it, as far as I'm aware. The department does do a fair number of those things, and so we work with the department using the statutes that deal with the administrative hearings process. They have an administrative hearings officer who is independent and hears cases and makes decisions on behalf of the director. These are individual decisions compared to or as contrasted with rules. Rules are broad application, not focused just on one person. So rulemaking is something that is real important to the department. Because that's how we let the public know how these statutes that you've been given get implemented. And the rulemaking process is a public process. It is a way for the public to see and create a process where they can engage with the state agency as it considers a rule all the way up to final adoption. Here is a chart of the rulemaking process, and I'll just hand it around so you can, you don't need to study it, that won't be a test, but it's not easy. It's not easy to adopt a permanent rule. There are a number of steps, and I won't go through all of them, but to adopt a regular permanent rule, there's sort of four steps. There's a notice that has to be filed. And there's a place called the Washington Register, and when you file things in it, there is the expectation or the the action that the public becomes aware of it. Whether they read the register or not, that's the way we check the box off that everybody gets notice of it. So the first requirement is you file this notice of an issue. That tells people you're considering an issue. If you want to move forward, the next step is you file a proposed rule. That's what we call the CR-102, and that's often when you first see the department on a rule. They will talk about a proposed rule. Then you need to have a public hearing. We often tie those things together at the same time so that you organize the public hearing. It happens in front of you. You get the input that's both oral and written, and then after a certain amount of time set by statute, you can come back and decide this thing. And you may adopt it as proposed. The staff may have changed it, and so it may be a different proposal by the time you're ready to consider it. You may make amendments to it. You may decide we don't like this rule at all and vote it down. But it is a sequential process with dates and timelines in between and certain requirements. The Act does go on and talk about how people can challenge rules. There is a statute in this section that allows people to propose a rule to you, whether you want to consider it or not. They can propose it. They can request you amend one of your rules or repeal it. And you see these often on your conference calls where the staff or the director comes and says, we got one of these requests, you know, to amend or to whatever. Here's the staff work on it, and they tee it up for you to decide. You're not deciding a rule at that time. You're deciding whether to direct the agency to engage in the process. So that's a public way to get you to consider a rule, whether you want to or not. Doesn't necessarily require that the rule be adopted. The calendar I showed you is the permanent rulemaking process. And when you adopt a permanent rule, it stays in effect until you do something with it. If you never changed it, it would stay on to infinity or whatever. But then you can come and amend it whenever you want. You can repeal it whenever you want. But it has permanence. You can also adopt on a much faster timeline an emergency rule. And that gets has much shorter deadlines. In fact, you can do it if you meet the emergency standards. You can do it right now and get it effective right now. But it does have certain, you have to meet a certain sort of emergency standard, and it has a time limit on it. So it's only effective for a little bit of time, and you can only adopt a second emergency rule of the same nature if you've started a permanent rulemaking. So to go beyond that time, you've got to sort of commit to let's really get this going. But the department does do a lot of emergency rules because there are certain things that happen fast and meet that emergency criteria, which allows the director, well, you've delegated the authority to adopt emergency rules to the director so that he can deal with things right away. So there is an emergency rule process. It's fast, but it does have some limitations compared to permanent rules. So the last thing I was going to talk about briefly is the Public Records Act. The public, all of the things that you create, that all of us create in our daily state worker life, becomes a public record. So the Public Record Act allows the public to access public records, and each agency has a public records officer, and people are to direct their inquiries to that person. That person is to work with the agency and try to find where are those records and get the agency to produce them. The Public Records Act has high penalties and attorney's fees, and there is a very active business in certain people suing on public records, maybe to get the records, but as often, a few, looking for mistakes and penalizing you. Public records is, because of that, public records is a really big deal and real important. And the department has, that department and my agency, we have really staffed up our public records people in order to try to create processes and find these public records and be responsive to the public, get records out to people as fast as we can and in the proper way. There is another set of laws that we don't use very often, but the department has record-keeping folks. And the state creates a schedule that identifies different records and determines how long records need to be kept. There are a number of records that are what we call transitory. There's cake in the lunchroom, we're meeting, you know, in room 307, which have no or very little lasting public value. So nobody in 10 years is going to want the public record. Was there cake in the lunchroom on this date? So these transitory records, the record schedule allows those to be deleted as soon as their business value is gone. Other records, and there is lists, and the department can create its own list, and we can provide more information to you if you want it sometime. But there are lists of categories and then a date or a saving date that require the records to be kept for different dates. More important records need to be kept for longer periods of time.
Are there any questions of the commissioners? Just let Bill continue. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so we can bring the public records officer sometime if you want to talk more about public records. It's a big deal to the agency, and we are both, this agency and my agency, are really invested in the last 5 years in trying to make better systems, computerizing things so that we're not looking in file cabinets for paper records, all of these things. But I just impress upon you that it is... when you get a public records request, we have to treat them really seriously and be very responsive. We try, if you create a record, if you give it to your executive assistant, then we are trying to use that as the place we search first. But if you create records in your state capacity, then those are public records. And if you don't want to give them to your executive assistant, you need to keep them and then be able to find them in the case there's a public records request for those types of things.
Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, Bill, and I probably know the answer in this, but is there any protocol in the public records request for abusive or extensive repetitive requests by individuals? Or, and I think you're getting the drift of what I'm saying, but is there any mechanism that after X number over X number of years or X number and within a period of time, or is this just blank check?
I believe the legislature has become aware of certain instances, or certain state agencies particularly. As far as I remember, and we can find out more, I mean, we are working with your public records staff all the time. Any public records requester that has regularly requesting records from the department doesn't yet meet that standard. The standard that the legislature has given to address those problems are high and extraordinary compared to sort of your situation right now.
Mr. Thorburn.
Since we're on the issue of records, one thing that we didn't talk about in the Open Public Meetings Act piece is the chain email meeting. You want to explain that?
Right. So back in the Open Public Meetings Act section, I should have mentioned this. Most of the time we think of meetings where you're all together or you're all on the phone. There is a... there hasn't been a lot of litigation on it, but there's an issue of, let's say one commissioner writes all of you an email, or the director writes all of you an email. Well, it's going to all of you, so the question is, does that create a open public meeting, that you're all seeing the same thing at once? And no, you can passively receive information. So we can send something to all nine of you at once. The director can. You can send something to all nine of you at once. The first shot is that doesn't create an open public meeting. If nine of you started talking all together by email, so not on the same day, not on the same minute, not in the same second, that is where you potentially have this discussion that really creates sort of an ongoing meeting, but it's not in public. And so that's the serial email problem. So if you want to send an email to your commissioners, that's fine. It's the engaging in the discussion by email that's the problem. So be aware of that.
I think we need to wrap up.
Yeah, that was...
Go ahead, Commissioner Baker.
One more question, please.
In terms of public records, it has been my my policy to file the records that I initiate or correspondence that I have carefully, because it takes way more time to go back and look over 10,000 emails than it does to have a good filing system. But the question is, part of my other practice is to delete, if I'm not interested, the many, many, many emails that we get every day from usually our executive assistant that's just passing through somebody else's concern, letter, whatever, yelling at us about something. And the reason that I feel like I can do that, and this is the question, is that she has that record. And if there's a public records request, so long as I haven't engaged back and it comes from the agency, I assume that that will be covered, that we'll deal with that on that end. I'm looking for whether that is acceptable or whether I'm screwing up.
So the creator of the record is responsible for keeping the record. However, in general, if your executive assistant sends a message to all of you, as long as you don't change the message, we're really looking at originals, is the theory. So she created the original. She's responsible for knowing what retention schedule. If you have it, and a public records request comes in, you probably have to send it in or say, I have records. But if they're all exact, what happen, at least what happens in our office is everybody has to send whatever they have. And so we're being encouraged to follow that record retention schedule and delete things that are appropriately deletable. So if you have it and you get a public records request, you probably have to give it, send it into the system, and then the system, your public records staff, they're the ones who respond to the requester. So the other time you would need to keep it is she sends the first message to all of you, you print it and make a bunch of notes on it. So she is responsible for the original. However, you've created a new original with your notes. So your notes become, you know, as you've changed it, you know, it becomes a different thing. So it's, yeah. And we can bring the public records staff, or we can bring, you know, Nancy from our office and provide more training if you want that.
Commissioner Kehoe, you got the last word.
So, you know, the last topic that you just brought up, kind of the serial emails among the commission. So, you know, there's two issues there, or two, as I understand it. You've got the Open Public Meeting Act, and then you also have the Public Record Act. So I mean, I certainly, any email that we generate, that we send to our fellow commissioners, or has any relationship with commission business, is certainly, you know, a subject to the Open Public Meeting Act, correct? You know, if I'm sending an email to a constituent, even on a matter that's related to fish and wildlife business, that is subject to the
public record.
Public record. I get them mixed up. So, but with respect to the Open Public Meeting Act, let's say, for example, we want to do business by email amongst committee members, for not a quorum. We can do that. We can exchange ideas, go back and forth, and, you know, for example, if we want to work on a recommendation to the full commission. That, my understanding is that is not a violation of the Open Public Meeting Act, because we are not acting as a quorum. Is that correct?
Yeah. Let me look at that one a little more and get back to you.
Because I think that enables us to do our committee work outside of just meeting, you know, our time when we meet together. I would like clarification for that. My sense would be is that, hey, if it's not a quorum, it's okay. Certainly it's subject to the Open Public Records Act, emails back and forth, you know, obviously. But I just want to make sure that we're not violating the Open Public Meeting Act when we are exchanging ideas amongst ourselves, when there's less of a when there's less than a quorum, particularly,
I understand.
You know, committee.
Yeah. I understand. Okay.
Bill, I want to thank you on behalf of all of us for your time. I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about, but thank you very much for doing this.
And we can bring subject matter experts if you want to hear more on any of these. It's most of the people are in Olympia, so we can do them at Olympia meetings, but whatever you'd like.
Thank you very much. We are now moving into agenda item 14. This is the commission brunch and workshop, and we will be moving into the Sawtooth Conference Room for that. This event is established for welcoming new commissioners and informal discussion. The meeting is open to the public. For those who wish to observe, there will be no public input taken. Thank you. Meeting stands adjourned.